Yet a Chaykin taping Leo and Leo and Sybil Zeftel for an oral history, July 9th, 1998. Okay. Leo, let's begin with you. Where were you born, and the city, the date? Tell us something.
I was born on August 7th, 1925, South Providence, Rhode Island. Rhode Island, incidentally, is the smallest state, and Delaware is the second smallest. So after many years, I really improved. I grew up in a very Orthodox home and spoke Yiddish before I spoke English. In fact, I learned English when I went to school.
So your parents were immigrants?
Parents were immigrants.
From where?
From Galicia. Both Galicianas. And there was a fairly large Jewish community in Providence. In fact, on one street they had three large synagogues. They had a synagogue from Russian Jews, a synagogue for mixed Jews who came from various places, and one street over had a synagogue for Galician Jews. And they had several small synagogues. This was all in South Providence. In North Providence, North End, you must have had about a dozen very small synagogues.
So it was a bustling Jewish community.
Yes. They had a street similar to what I'm told Second Street was in Wilmington. All Jewish shops, butcher shops, groceries, fish markets, and synagogues. And they would close Friday afternoon, not open again until after sunset on Saturday.
Well, actually, Chesed Shlemeth in Wilmington was very similar to that in Wilmington. At 3rd and Shipley, that was the same kind of thing.
But even these, the markets, every one closed. Recall at one point, it finally started to open. I worked on one of these markets on a Saturday morning, and when the people came by from the synagogue, I would hide them back.
So they wouldn't see you.
So they wouldn't see me.
What did your father do?
My father worked in a jewelry factory. Providence was a center for low-cost costume jewelry. My mother was basically a homemaker.
Uh-huh. And did you have siblings?
I had one brother who was 7 years younger than I. We went to public schools in the general area. We'd always walk to school. We lived in a rented apartment, a flat. It had 2- and 3-story homes in the general area.
Tenements, they called them.
Tenements? Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then when you finished your schooling, where did you go?
Well, I went to Brown University, which is in Providence.
In Providence.
Because I could live at home and go to school. I might add that one of the things that I did, which has a bearing later on in life, they used to sell peso blots for Puella Zion, 50 cents a copy, to raise money for Israel. This was when I was about 12 years old.
Were your parents Zionists?
No, but they had a relative who was, whose name I can no longer recall, and he was a Zionist.
And so that was a spurred you on in that direction, right?
I went to a cheder where I learned Hebrew prayer. The one thing I'd never learned was how to speak Hebrew. I could sight read the Torah. I got a very good Jewish education, except for speaking Hebrew.
Well, I don't think in those days they
spoke
Hebrew. No, it was the language of the Bible.
I used to read the Forbits and the Tug.
In
the Yiddish one.
Right. And then after Brown.
After Brown, I went to the University of Rochester. And after 1 year, I got married to Sybil, who also grew up in Providence, whom I had known from high school. Her family and our families knew each other, but we weren't socially friendly at that time. After married at Rochester, after my first year, we stayed there another year and a half, almost 2 years. And then came down to work for DuPont in Wilmington.
And at Rochester, what was your, what did you major in?
Organic chemistry. Got a PhD in organic chemistry.
And how, what led you in that direction?
Well, that started way back in high school. I had a very good chemistry teacher named Louis Kramer. Is this coming through?
Yeah.
Name was Louis Kramer. I wanted to be a lawyer. And after I took chemistry with him, I decided I'd rather be a chemist. He was sort of a frustrated chemist who during Depression years became a teacher.
So he was your mentor?
He was my mentor in high school. And as a result of, after high school, I worked for a year to raise money for college. College was very expensive in those days. It was $250 a semester.
The tuition.
The tuition.
Yeah. And was this at Brown?
This was at Brown.
Uh-huh.
I worked for a year in both the defense industry, Brown and Sharp. And
yeah, because the war, World War II was
approaching.
Was on, wasn't it?
What was on?
Yeah, right.
I was too young.
Let me just put touch your arm so you just stop shaking, okay?
Okay. I was too young.
Yeah.
I got in a year of college, then got drafted. So I left. I went, entered Brown in 43, left Brown in 43 at the end of the second semester, and went off to war. I came back in 46.
Where did you serve?
Well, all my training was for the Pacific, and I was in California, and they suddenly needed more people in Europe. So I was took a train back, troop train, back to the East Coast, shipped off and went to France, served in France, Germany. I was in Austria when the war ended in Europe. Spent a month there, shipped back to the United States.
And what kind of unit were you in?
Infantry. Anti-tank unit. I was supposed to go to officer candidate school and become a chemical officer, but they suddenly needed more people. I wound up in the infantry.
And so did you see action?
Yes. Saw action in Germany
and in
Austria.
I thought it was the Battle of the Bulge.
No.
No.
Right after the Battle of the Bulge.
Ah.
I wound up, my first action was in Cologne, Germany. Somebody was shooting at me and I was shooting at them. I was almost scared of my life.
I'm sure.
At that point, you suddenly realize someone out there wants to kill you.
Yeah.
You know, you're a body, not even a face.
Yeah. Did it have an effect upon you in terms of later life?
I think so. I didn't finish my war. After I came back to the States, I shipped off to the Pacific. And on the way to the Pacific, they dropped the bomb. So we kept going, and I spent a year in the Philippines after the war was over. But I was originally trained, and we shipped back to the Pacific to be in one of the assault waves on Japan. Very glad they dropped the bomb.
Yeah. Well, did you have any children? You were married.
No,
oh,
I wasn't
married. Married yet. It was before.
No, that was still while I was still going to the front.
I see.
Oh.
It was 18 or 19.
Okay. all right. So you came back, and then
came
you went...
Back, finished up at Brown, then went to Rochester. At the end of my first year in Rochester, Sybil and I got married.
And then you lived there
until
you finished your degree.
Finished my degree, and then came down, started work for DuPont in 1950, August 1st, 1951.
And so you worked for DuPont how many years?
38 years.
Oh, wow.
I retired from DuPont July 31st, 1989.
And what were what was the type of work that you did for them, and what was your overall record at DuPont?
Well, various kinds of organic chemistry, then some plant manufacturing work, and various staff jobs. And the highlight of my DuPont career came towards the end. In the last 2 years, I got involved representing DuPont and the chemical industry and helping the U.S. government get the Chemical Weapons Treaty through. So I represented DuPont at the Chemical Manufacturers Association and got to work on the Chemical Weapons Treaty. And when I retired from DuPont, had a contract with DuPont for 2 years to continue that kind of work. And then when that contract ended, Chemical Manufacturers Association gave me a contract to work for them. And I think it's the greatest thing I ever did in the chemical industry.
And also for world peace.
Yes. My children certainly felt that way also. They always had some reservations about my being a chemist.
Until you were able to.
Until I was able to do this kind of work.
And what kind of people did you meet when you were doing this?
That was very exciting. I met people from industry, both in this country and from various European countries, Japan and so on. And then I met people from the academic world, met people in various governments. I attended meetings in Geneva, at The Hague, in Italy, in Jordan, in France. Many of these were at the invitation of the various governments involved in the treaty. Spoke at various seminars, and really, not only did I enjoy the work, but I felt I was doing something useful.
You mentioned Australia?
Went to a big conference in Australia. Right after I retired from DuPont, DuPont Company still sent me to Australia, representing them at this conference of 130-some countries and their industrial representatives, as well as government representatives. I was one of four people representing the U.S. government from the chemical industry.
Did DuPont continue to send you to this to the end?
DuPont sent me, when DuPont stopped sending me, at the end of my two-year contract, DuPont stopped sending me, but Chemical Manufacturers Association, CMA, they paid my expenses to go to these meetings. So I represented chemical industry as part of CMA, became a consultant to CMA. I also became a consultant to several government organizations who were working on the treaty, and several government contractors who worked on various aspects of the treaty. I arranged for visits to various chemical plants, most of which were owned by DuPont. But I had some other contacts. One of my biggest visits was to have be one of the people that hosted 15 Russians who visited the DuPont Chambers Works, where I had worked for 32 of my 38 years.
And they came on behalf?
They came on behalf of the Russian government. As part of a treaty worked out, it's called an MOU, Memorandum of Understanding, worked out between Shevardnadze, Edward Shevardnadze, who was then the Prime Minister, Foreign Secretary, Prime Minister of Russia, and Jim Baker, who was the Secretary of State for the U.S. That was in 1990. And because of my having introduced various U.S. government people to the Chambers Works to see what a chemical plant looked like, the government asked DuPont if they could use Chambers Works as an example for the Russians to visit a U.S. plant. And I was very involved in that.
So you were like the host of that?
Well, yeah, I was the semi-official host. Plant manager was the actual host. But when it came time to answer questions, hold discussions with the Russians, he would turn to me.
Mm-hmm.
Made me feel very important.
Well, you were very important.
Also, I had a lot of fun doing it.
Well, and now Shevardnadze, of course, is the president of Georgia,
right.
State of Georgia.
Yes.
So when the actual signing took place...
That signing took place in Paris in 1993, and I got to go there to attend the signing. I might add that many of these trips abroad, Sybil was able to go with me, which made it even more enjoyable. She got to know Geneva very well, and also The Hague. But in many of these instances, the Dutch government, for example, asked me to come and participate in a seminar, and they paid my expenses. The Italian government asked me to come twice and participate in seminars with the governments.
Who's going to hold these
meetings? They sponsored. And the Jordanian government sponsored a seminar.
Well, when these people sponsored seminars, they paid for your...
They paid for my coming.
Uh-huh.
The seminars that were held in Geneva, CMA or DuPont paid for my going.
I see. Now, has the chemical ban treaty was signed and you were present at the signing?
Yes. It was a very, very impressive ceremony. Every Secretary of State or representative of a country that was going to sign was allowed 5 minutes to speak. Eagleburger was the U.S. Secretary of State at that time. He spoke for about 7 minutes. Many of the people spoke for 15. And we were shuddering up in the audience because we were envisioning 130 people speaking for more than 5 minutes each.
How many days did it take for them?
It took about 4 days for all the speakers to get through. Mitterrand, who was the president of France, hosted the meeting at that point.
And who spoke for Israel? I can't remember that.
Peretz spoke for Israel.
Because Rabin at that time was the prime minister.
No, but Peretz.
Yeah, I know. He was the defense minister, but I think...
Foreign secretary.
Uh-huh.
Something, whatever he was, he spoke. He started off speaking in Hebrew, quickly switched to French, and then switched to English. I was very impressed.
Well, you were in pretty heady company, weren't you?
Yes. I also attend a lot of private meetings hosted by various embassies because I was one of the people that they knew. And so I went to one hosted by the French government in a very private, plush hotel, private room. I went to a luncheon. There were about 20 people. I was hosted by the Australian embassy. I was seated between the advisors to Mitterrand and also a German ambassador. I got to know the Mr. Ambassador Caius, who became head of UNSCOM for a while, is now the ambassador to the United States. But he headed up the Geneva meeting for a while. I got to know him on a first name basis. I got to know a lot of these people.
The chemical ban treaty was signed and it's in effect now. And what would you say of its effect?
Well,
would you evaluate
it? It has two parts to it. First was the signing and then the ratification. We have ratified it, but we haven't completed the requirements, we being the U.S.
But all the other nations?
Not all.
Not all. No. No,
I think Israel hasn't either.
About 130 some nations have signed it. Over 90 have now ratified it. Israel has not ratified it or signed it because they would have to allow access
to
their defense installation.
Well, is that a defect? Is that a problem with it?
Yes. Obviously some of the rogue states, Iraq, Libya, Sudan.
They'll never sign it.
They have not signed it and have not ratified it. But what it has done, North Korea has not signed. But what it really serves, its major effect is to serve as a deterrent in two ways. One is going to make it harder to carry on manufacture of chemical weapon agents. And the other is that if you feel that your neighbor has signed and ratified it, and you're not so much afraid that he may have chemical weapons and you don't, so you're not going to necessarily engage in manufacture chemical weapons.
So the overall effect is very positive.
The overall effect is very positive. Two other aspects of it. While the treaty was being worked on, the only two countries that would admit that they had chemical weapons were the Russians and the U.S. Everybody else either denied it or wouldn't make any comments. After the treaty was signed, began to get ratified, the British admitted that they had some chemical weapons, the French admitted they had chemical weapons, and several other countries had small stockpiles. The major stockpiles were an admitted 40,000 tons by the Russians and 30,000 tons by us.
Well, the Russians are still a problem, aren't they?
Well, the problem is to destroy the chemical weapons. It's very expensive, very difficult to destroy them completely. The Russians would like to have money from us to help them destroy their chemical weapons. We are destroying chemical weapons in a place called Johnston Island, which is in the South Pacific, and also various locations in the United States. The Russians would like us to put up several $1 billion, have them build a facility. And we can't, the way their weapons are constructed, we cannot destroy them in our facilities. They don't fit. There's also a lot of discussion and objection to people in this country to how we destroy the chemical weapon. Some people feel that we're not using the best technology. Well, we're using the best that is known at the moment. Some people will not let us transport chemical weapons from one state to another for fear that they may spring a leak. And instead, where they are, they're leaking. So we're trying to construct a destruction facility near where the weapons are located. And the one good thing that's happened from the treaty is that, as I say, people are starting to destroy what they have. And they're also inspecting military facilities where the weapons are located to see what the stockpile is. I've gotten to see a major stockpile that we have at Tooele, Utah. Tooele is about 30 miles south.
How do you spell that?
T-O-O-E-L-E.
Okay.
It's about 30 miles south of Salt Lake City. They have these large bunkers. If you remember what Quonset huts used to look like, you may not, but Quonset huts came from Quonset Point, Rhode Island. Anyway, they have these large bunker-type installations and a very well-guarded facility. And it's an interesting thing in itself. In front of the door, there's a 5-ton cement block that's on railroad rails, so it can only be lifted up in one direction, and a bank vault door, and then you get inside wearing a gas mask. And I've been inside some of these bunkers to count how many we had of either rockets or shells or landmines. And it's scary.
Yeah, but if a country like Russia is not as careful, is there danger? And are they selling some of their stockpiles?
As far as we know, they're not selling any. There is danger if they don't destroy it properly. Danger that the people working on the destruction will get killed. When they went into Iraq after the Gulf War, they were destroying stockpiles of chemical weapons agents. And a number of Iraqis were killed because they were very careless.
Or they didn't realize the danger.
They realized it, but the manufacture of chemical weapons is a very dangerous operation. If you don't care about loss of life of your people, you don't take all the precautions. So you may recognize the danger, but you don't really care about the people themselves.
Mm-hmm. Well,
I've seen a picture of an Iraqi soldier trying to blow up a shell that contained chemical weapons agent material. And it blew up prematurely, sprayed him with the agent. He was dead within 2 or 3 minutes.
Oh, wow. So it's truly a talk of dangerous.
They're very dangerous. Some of these nerve agents, a drop in your eye will kill you in less than 2 minutes.
Well, you
drop on your skin, you might last 5 minutes.
So they take great precautions.
Extremely great precautions.
Yeah. And so, since the United States has not ratified the treaty,
no.
But they seem
we've ratified it.
I mean, but we haven't.
We haven't completed. One part of the ratification is that you should have implementing legislation, which says that you will have certain legal constraints for the manufacturers of all chemicals, and legal constraints having to do with inspection of chemical plant facilities. A bill spelling out these legal restrictions has currently been passed by the House and by the Senate, is waiting Clinton's signature. And that's really current. That's up to within the past 2 weeks.
Ah, so there is a possibility that we
will fully be in full compliance.
Oh, well, I never thought that would happen.
Well, I had reservations as to whether it would happen and within the next 10 years. There are a lot of political aspects involved, because what it means also is that any chemical plant that makes any chemical that could be used in any remote way, make chemical weapons, is subject to inspection. It may not be inspected, but it's eligible for inspection. And you've got to remember that part of the problem is that most chemicals have dual use. The thiodiglycol, thiodiglycol, is an ingredient in ballpoint pen inks. So anyone carrying a ballpoint pen probably has a drop or so of thiodiglycol in the ink system. That material, coupled with another material, makes mustard gas, which is really a heavy liquid, a very heavy oily liquid that can be dispersed into a gas.
It's potent.
And that's a very corrosive material. So you have dual use of a lot of chemicals that can be used, civil use.
What, you were involved in a million, do you want to?
No, that's all right. I've done it too, it's recorded.
Yeah. Yes. You were involved in many activities in our community.
Well, I
can you remember some of them?
Yes. I remember my first one very well. Somebody got me to go around and solicit on a federation. Jewish Federation, which at that time was called Jewish Federation of Wilmington, subsequently Jewish Federation of Delaware.
What year was that?
That was probably 1953, 54. And they gave me five cards, each of whom people represented on the card had contributed $5 the year before. And I went around to five different homes, four of which were relatively easy, scattered around the city. And the fifth one was a young man whose last name was Weiner. William Weiner's son, Weiner.
Right.
He was sleeping at 11 o'clock on a Sunday morning. His mother didn't want to awaken him. I had to go back three times before I caught up with him. Anyway, the five cards the year before had pledged $25. The year I solicited, he pledged $40. And everybody thought that was a great accomplishment.
So that was your first introduction.
And after that, I solicited fairly regularly for the Federation, got involved, eventually got appointed to the Federation Board. I was also involved, subsequent to that time, I became an officer of the Federation, campaign chairman, and then became president of the Federation.
What year was that?
76, I believe.
Okay.
Or 77.
Yeah, because I think that's the year I must become head of the Jewish Voice at your instigation. You got many people to work for you.
Well, I found if you work for people, they pretend to work for you.
Right.
There are a lot of good people in the community. I also was on the Jewish Community Center board for a while, just about the time they were working on the building of the new center. And I was involved in activities at Temple Beth Emma, which we joined in 1955, 56.
You made a switch from your very Orthodox world to a very Reform world. What caused that?
Well, one of the reasons was that I felt I couldn't live as an Orthodox Jew the way I lived my life. And I have to amplify that. It had nothing to do with religion. It was custom. I personally couldn't get myself not to ride on to drive on Sabbath
Shabbat
and be Orthodox. I don't keep kosher, so I don't eat pork. But I found that I felt that I couldn't live with myself if I joined an Orthodox congregation and didn't observe, did not observe their practices. And some of our friends had belonged to Beth Emmet, and I liked.
You like the friends.
I like the friends, so we joined Beth Emmet.
And you ultimately became president, didn't
Eventually
you?
Eventually I became president of Beth Emmet.
And what year was that, do you remember?
It was probably 75.
Before the Federation?
Before the Federation.
Uh-huh.
In fact, Federation may have been as late as 1980. I'd have to check my memory fails
as to what year. Did DuPont encourage people who work for them to be active in the community?
Yes, not necessarily in the Jewish community, but active in the community.
Uh-huh. Were you active in other things?
Trying to think.
I don't know. There are a million boards and things.
A number of different kind of boards, but I can't really recall.
Yeah, that's right.
At this point.
That's right.
I was captain of the DuPont Country Club bridge team.
Well, and you and Sybil traveled a lot, vacation-wise.
We traveled a fair amount vacation-wise. And then once I got involved with the Chemical Weapons Treaty.
Then you really?
I really traveled.
Yeah.
I usually wound up in Europe a minimum of twice a year, and sometimes as many as four or five times, sometimes for a long weekend, sometimes for a whole week.
What years did that chemical treaty ban cover?
From my viewpoint,
yeah,
1987.
That's when you began?
That's when industry really got involved at the request of the U.S. government.
Uh-huh.
I went to my first Washington meeting in March of 1987. In June, they asked me to go represent them, along with a couple of other people, in Geneva. So Sybil and I went to Geneva at the end of June, spent a week in Geneva, and took a trip through Italy, visit our good friends, the Scholls. Incidentally, that's someone you ought to interview if you get a chance.
Yeah, and maybe next time Ed comes, you'll call me. I'd like to.
He holds the record of being the person who, after spending like 1 week in Wilmington, walked into the Federation office and said, "What can I do to help?"
Oh, wow. Well, a wonderful role model himself.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, you think of things, whereas I'm going to move this over to Sybil. And Sybil, suppose you start with your background, where you were born.
I was born in Providence, Rhode Island, June 4th, 1926. I have a whole family of siblings. I have three sisters and two brothers. I'm the next to the oldest. My father was born in what became Czechoslovakia. My mother was born in Providence, although her parents came to the United States only a few months before her birth.
So she went to school. I mean, she was educated.
She was educated mm-hmm. in Providence. My father came to this country when he was in his teens, and I think he had some education in the city, but he worked with his father. They began with a grocery store, and then they ended up in the coal business. But my father's brother, who was 1 or 2 years younger than he, actually graduated from Brown University.
Oh, wow.
My father's family was very involved in Jewish community organizations in the city.
Where'd you go to school?
I went to public school.
I meant, and then you went
and
to...
And then I went to Brown. And it was Pembroke in those days.
Yeah, women's. They had a women's school, right?
Women's school.
And so you knew each other there.
Yes, we knew. We went to the same high school. We knew each other.
So you knew each other. Were you dating already?
Not until college.
First date was...
After.
The night after Rosh Hashanah.
Right after.
And then you majored in?
I majored in math. And after college, I taught for a year at Simmons College. And then Leo and I were married. And I moved to Rochester, where I had a job at the university for not a technical job at all. I worked for the American Chemical Society. Then when we moved to Wilmington,
Do you had children before you came here?
No.
Oh, you had your children
here? We had our children here. When we came to Wilmington, I worked at Hercules for almost a year, and then I had my first child. And I didn't work again until my youngest child was in the first grade.
Well, tell me about both the children that you both have.
Well, Mona was born when we were here about a year. Peter is 3 years younger than Mona, and then Julie is 2.5 years younger than Peter. So that our children all grew up in Wilmington, and how much more do you want
to
know about?
Well, I wanted to know, first of all, you went to work.
I went to work when Julie was in the first grade. I taught math first at Springer Junior High, then in the middle of when DSEG came about, I went to several other schools, and I ended up teaching at Mount Pleasant High School.
And your children all went through the Mount Pleasant School?
Peter started in the Brandywine, then switched to Mount Pleasant, and they went through the Mount Pleasant school system.
And then so besides teaching and raising a family, you also were involved in community.
Oh, yeah, I was.
And you have to try to think,
I was, when I first came to town, I became, not first, but after a while, I joined the League of Women Voters. That was the first community organization that I really had any involvement with. I was on the League board for a few years, and then I also joined the National Council of Jewish Women, and I was the president of council.
That's the Council of Jewish Women.
The National Council of Jewish Women, Wilmington section. I was the president of that for 2 years, and then that was before I went to work. Once I went to work,
The County Merit Commission.
Oh, I forgot about that. Yeah.
Thank you.
That's right. Because I had been involved in the Lyndon Johnson campaign, I had been the head of the volunteer Citizens for Johnson volunteer group office. When they needed someone, they wanted to nominate someone for the Newcastle County Merit System, the League had nominated me, and so I was on the first Newcastle County Merit System.
Chairperson.
Okay, you're right, I was chairperson. and that lasted for a few years. And then
what happened to the merit system?
It still exists.
Still exists.
Yes, but when what's his name, Connor? What was his first name, Connor?
I can't remember.
Was it Bill? I think Bill.
Connor.
Yeah, Bill Connor.
When he became the county executive, he replaced me because I was a Democrat.
Okay.
And after that, I decided that it was time for me to go to work, I guess. That's when I started teaching. Then when I retired from teaching...
How many years did you teach?
20.
20 years.
Okay. When I retired from teaching, I...
And you taught math the entire time?
Yes. I taught both junior high and then high school math. I still meet old students or students who... I remember who remembered me. That was very funny. This young man who's cutting the wood for us, he said to me, "Did you used to be a school teacher?"
Yeah.
And I said, "Yes." And he said, "Well, a friend of mine, Miles Cotting, said he had you, and he wants to apologize because he was so bad in your class."
That's funny. you can't get away from it.
No, you can't get away from it. And then, after retirement, my involvement was in two areas. I became very involved in Sojourner's Place.
Well, tell us what Sojourner's Place
is. Sojourner's Place is a shelter for the homeless. It evolved from this warehouse at the firehouse in downtown Wilmington, and then when the firehouse was closed because someone wanted to build on it. I think it turned out to be MBNA, didn't it? That built on that.
Yeah,
site.
I think it was.
Anyway, they finally looked for a new place and they developed a new program.
Who's they?
The board of Sojourners and Sister Jean Cashman.
Uh-huh. And you were on the board.
I was on the board. I wasn't on the board initially. I was just an interested citizen and was going to their meetings when they were evolving. And they developed a program which became Sojourner's Place, which includes education and work and taking people in to live there who will be willing to work at trying to change their lives. And they have been what I consider a highly successful program. And
well, you should be proud of your work.
Well,
with them.
I'm proud of the organization. My work is just as a, you know, I've been involved first on...
Very actively.
I'm very committed to what they're doing, and I've been involved on the development committee. Actually, I'm on leave at the moment. Ben Epstein is
taking
my place, but they do a very successful job, and I think they deserve a lot of support. The other thing I was involved in from its inception was the Project for Domestic Violence Reform that changed its name now to something else. Project. I don't remember the new name, but this was...
And what did it grow out of?
It grew out of a committee from National Council of Jewish Women and Child, Inc. Helen Rubin and I and Joe DeLolio decided we wanted to do something about battered women.
What, Harriet?
She came in later. She did a lot of work, but it was really Helen Rubin, Joe DeLolio, and I who decided, well, what can we do? And we set up a committee that expanded, and it included a lot of other people from council, also from the police department and from various other areas of the community, and including some people from the University of Delaware who were from the Women's Studies Group. And we worked for about a year and held a very big conference at the University of Delaware on the problems of domestic violence. And after that conference, we decided, well, where do we go from here? And we just continued meeting for about 2 or 3 years until we decided, Judge Papadi had...
From Family Court.
From Family Court had been very eager to have a volunteer group work with battered women. And so that's how the program evolved. We had space in Family Court, and we were advocates for battered women. Now it's expanded beyond that now. And
so now they have space in Family Court, and they
also have an office in the Community Service Building.
Oh, I see.
And they are working on education programs for high schools. They work on legislation, and they work on...
I think now they have a regular executive director.
They have an executive director, mm-hmm, as well as a volunteer coordinator. And it's expanded considerably from its beginnings.
Right.
I think it's been a very effective program.
Now, I will say, some of you have really made a wonderful contribution. Where are your children now? And what are they doing?
Well, our oldest daughter, Mona, lives in outside of Boston. She works for a small software company, and she has two children aged 5 and 7. Peter lives in Minneapolis, and he works with preschoolers for the public school system of Minneapolis. Julie has just moved to Manhattan and has started a job at the Metropolitan Museum. She has two children, 6 and 10. And we feel lucky that we have 4 grandchildren who we see as often as we can.
Oh, well, we're happy to have both of you here, and we thank you very much for your interview.
Thank you.